After 7 years watching over the privacy of New Zealanders, John Edwards is off to do the same for those in the UK. He was first appointed to the role of Privacy Commissioner in 2014 and reappointed in 2019. He finished up just over a week ago and will head to the UK to start the new year as Information Commissioner. During his time, he's been outspoken in the role and a champion for privacy, as one might expect, but his criticism of Facebook in particular, in the wake of the Christchurch mosque attacks, which were live-streamed by the social media giant, netted him international media attention. John Edwards is with us now, taking a break from what I expect is a bit of a flurry of last-minute preparations for departure. John, good morning. Morena.
You're right, Catherine. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks. How are things going?
Very well. As you say, a flurry of departure. I've got about 30 kilograms more in my bags than I'm allowed to take, so I need to have a second run at that. But no, it's exciting. And yeah, Merry Christmas to you and to your listeners.
Thank you. Let's look first quickly back over those 7 years, if we can. I guess some of the big themes that emerged in that time, the technology keeps moving, the challenges towards privacy keep moving. What would you say have been some of the standouts, and have things with respect to privacy got stronger or less strong?
Well, there's a lot in that question. There have been some trends, I suppose. One of them I think I've described as the kind of retail availability of digital technologies. And that means that it's just so easy for businesses now to access the kinds of quite intrusive technologies that harvest personal information, process it in ways that are unexpected. And we've also seen an increasing trend towards significant breaches of privacy, you know, security lapses that have potential to harm vast numbers of people. So these, you know, either malicious acts or careless acts leading to very sensitive personal information being released into the wilds.
So that's one example. Another might be we had a run of problems with government botching privacy and data breaches, etc. Have we seen improvements in security from that perspective?
Yes, we have. We've seen, I think, over the last 8 years, an increasing consciousness of the importance of protecting privacy and security. But, you know, the threats are increasingly sophisticated, Catherine, and I wish I could say that I was leaving the country and the infrastructure in a more foolproof state. But sadly, you know, just this year, we've seen the terrible ransomware attack on Waikato DHB, which initially paralyzed its systems and meant that health services couldn't be provided. Now, that is literally a life and death situation. And it shows just how important this stuff is. But then as a part of that attack, the ransomware operators, the attackers, exfiltrated something like 20 gigabytes of the most sensitive information that you can imagine, covering people's experiences with health services. Now, I had messages from people around the world saying, you know, I'm really worried. I had a mental health crisis in, you know, 2015. How do I know if I'm included in this hack? So these security lapses have a real impact on people's sense of well-being and their kind of personal security. So, you know, we have seen an awakening to that, and we have seen improvements, but we need to see constant vigilance. You know, privacy is a bit like health and safety in the workplace. It's not something that's ever done and over. You've never sort of managed the risks and you can sort of wipe your hands and go off and do something else. It requires a constant effort to be vigilant about the technical security, but really importantly, about the kind of cultural expectations and settings you have in your organisation.
I wanted to ask you about that, because the technological security challenges are one thing, right? But a second and very important point is the attitudes of government departments, government agencies, and of corporates towards people's privacy. Are we seeing an understanding that this is A, the rights of people, but B, also what customers and clients are going to demand? What's happening to that culture within the private and public sector?
Yeah, I think we have seen that. We've seen that increasingly. And, you know, a really good example I'll give one example from the private sector and one from the public. In the private sector, you know, you've seen what is the biggest company in the world. Well, actually, I haven't checked today. Microsoft might have slipped ahead. But, you know, Apple has made a business model out of protecting privacy. So there'll be skeptics out there who say, well, you know, they've got their own purposes. This is a devices business, not a data business. You know, those comments, they may well be justified, I don't know. But the point is that company has decided to bet the farm on consumers valuing privacy and offering products that, in fact, make it easy for them to protect their privacy. So you've seen that with the ad tracking stuff through apps offered through the App Store. So that's one example that there is increasingly recognised a business value in protecting privacy. And that, you know, to me has always been a bit of a no-brainer. The second one, and it's a really interesting case. Dean Knight was talking with you yesterday about it, actually. This is the Whanaua Waiparera Trust lawsuit against the Ministry of Health to get access to data about unvaccinated Māori. Now, the ministry, in my view, acted in absolute good faith and was really concerned to ensure that the privacy of unvaccinated people that they had in their database was protected. And, the court has found, as Waiparera asserted, that they got that wrong, that they valued the privacy, they assessed it slightly wrong, and they valued it over more important interests. But again, what that tells us is that the Ministry of Health and government in general is acutely aware of the importance of privacy, and particularly in the pandemic context, the necessity of assuring people that privacy of their personal information will be protected as part of the kind of social license for accepting a bunch of other sort of intrusions into their rights.
What about the police? There was that example, and you'll have to refresh my memory of it, of young people being photographed, feeling like they were essentially being profiled by police. Did you investigate that or similar issues?
We launched a joint investigation with the Independent Police Conduct Authority after hearing coverage of that from Radio New Zealand. And that process is still in train. So I can't update you on conclusions of that. But yeah, I mean, what we have found is that I think as this goes to the first point that I made, as the technology has evolved and, you know, has put a phone in everyone's pocket, the policy and the process and the culture hasn't necessarily caught up. So whereas in the past, photographing a suspect was quite a regimented process. You know, you brought them into the station. There was a police photographer and a room and a place and, you know, and a profile and a set of rules. Nowadays, any officer can just whip out a phone from their pocket and you know, grab a few images of someone. And so we have made some suggestions, I think it's, I can say, to police about the need to update some of those policies and be clear about a legal basis for photography, particularly of young and vulnerable people.
In principle, would you argue, I can't speak to the facts of what you've been investigated, in principle, would you argue that police should not be taking photos of people just because they happen to be young and outside at a certain time of day?
Yes, I would say that. I would also say that as a matter of law. But, you know, there's some intricacies involved in this that we'll set out in detail that I'll agree with the Independent Police Conduct Authority and that we will have given police a good opportunity to reflect on and comment on before we make a report public. And I expect that to be made public in the first quarter of next year. We were supposed to get it wrapped up in September, but for a bunch of reasons, not lockdowns being one of them, we weren't able to meet that
deadline.
Okay.
One of the most recent things you've been involved with is putting the tenancy market on notice, a market that's only getting bigger in this housing crisis. Where are the problems there, and how might the compliance monitoring program your office has launched help? There's been the business, haven't there, of the so-called sort of blacklists that are often private members groups. What's happening in this area?
Yeah, so quite a lot, actually. We've had a long and really productive engagement with the residential tenancy market, both property managers, landlords, and representatives of tenants groups. And, you know, it's pretty universally agreed that there's a real squeeze. So there's a power asymmetry that means renters are at quite a disadvantage. And what that means is that, or how that's been reflected in our world, is that landlords have felt that they're able to ask for more and more information, have more and more intrusive practices, and the tenants have felt powerless to stand up for themselves. Now, as you know, Catherine, the Privacy Act acts at a really sort of quite high level of principles, and it says things like, don't collect personal information unless you've got a lawful purpose for it. And that's what we call in Europe the data minimization rule. But it's quite general, so it calls for individuals, landlords and so on, to make their own call about, well, what is necessary for me to rent this tenancy? And we've decided to help them by getting more specific and issuing more clear guidance. So we're saying things like, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, a particular landlord sat up at a select committee and said that she found it very useful to scrutinise bank statements because she might see that they eat a lot of KFC, a prospective tenant, and that will tell her something that about their discretionary spending and their suitability for her tenancy. Well, we just thought that was nonsense. That was a kind of proxy for something that she probably oughtn't to have been taking into account, and that people shouldn't have to submit every detail of their lives just to get a place
well,
in
how do you feel about banks requiring exactly that thing right now, by the way, as part of the new credit lending laws?
Yes. Well, banks have that access already because most of us don't conduct cash businesses. So they do have access to an awful lot of information about our lifestyles, and how they, use that is also subject to the Privacy Act. And if they make assumptions about our ability to service loans based on our choice of diet, then I would expect them to face the same scrutiny. But you asked about you asked about the compliance and enforcement. So what we've done is we've worked with the sector, we've put our money down, we've put some lines in the sand and said, well, here's some things that you can collect, here's some things that you just should never collect. Now I don't think there's any excuse for a landlord to say they were not aware of the requirements. So we move from that educative phase into a compliance and monitoring phase where we are going to be going out and looking for bad practice, issuing some compliance notices, and starting to try and get some of the enforcement powers in play that we were given in the Privacy Act when it came in a year ago. At the beginning of this month.
John Edwards, our guest, the departing Privacy Commissioner from New Zealand, is heading to the UK to become their Information Commissioner, which, interesting, also means he's responsible for what's the equivalent of our Official Information Act releases. I want to start, John, just for this final segment about what you're going to be doing there, though. You're going into a very different media environment with the Red Tops, right? I understand there's an investigation underway into how the Matt Hancock images, personal images of him, kissing his girlfriend, frankly, during the pandemic that ended up all over the media all over the world. Investigation as to how that information made it to the media rather than into the media itself. But what are you anticipating dealing with in a very different arena?
The office will continue to be subject to close scrutiny from the media. I welcome that. We are exercising statutory powers and we need to be accountable for those. I'm accountable to Parliament, but, the media also takes an interest and, there's often been a tension described between freedom of the press, freedom of expression, and privacy. And you've seen that play out in the UK recently, not in relation to data protection or privacy as we know it here, but in the courts in relation to the press's publication of Meghan Markle's correspondence. And, you know, the courts have made findings that uphold privacy values over freedom of press values. And again, that's alighted quite a considerable debate there about the role of the judiciary and the respective weights to be given to those privacy and freedom of press values. And that's a healthy debate. And I think that my office will contribute to that.
Can you see an involvement of your office in a case like the Matt Hancock, health minister at the time, telling everyone else not to associate with anyone out of their bubble? And yes, clearly this image, which appears to be CCTV footage, someone has accessed and someone has taken to the media. But where does the line lie between public interest in a minister on the face of it, prima facie, breaching his own rules, and the use of a particular kind of data? Perhaps images of the Downing Street infamous Christmas party might have been another example. What are the potential privacy issues versus public right to know?
Yeah, it's an interesting issue, and it's one that came up. I had a process of hearing in front of a select committee. Parliament has a sort of oversight role and has to hear from any prospective appointments such as mine. They don't get to veto it, but they were kind enough to confirm my appointment. But this very question came up, and, you know, in relation to the Matt Hancock matter. It is possible to clearly distinguish the sort of legal rules that apply. The public interest is served by offering a protection to the media when they publish something that is manifestly in the public interest. And I think there was a bit of confusion around this. So, you know, neither Matt Hancock nor anyone else sued, was it the Telegraph? I can't remember which outlet published it. Nobody sued them for publishing it and said, you should not publish this material. And if they had, those outlets would have been able to assert a public interest defense and say, well, yes, it's private information, but, you know, we think the public is entitled to know because maybe this illustrates a double standard or you know, some hypocrisy or the like. That's an entirely separate question from the one which says, if there is a CCTV camera in a public space that is maintained by a government organization for a particular purpose, being the security of that space and that organization, then certain rules apply to that. And if those rules are breached and somebody leaks that information or takes it out and uses it for a purpose other than for which it was originally collected, then that is a matter for investigation by the Office of
Interesting.
The Commissioner.
Interesting. That might come up
and,
again.
And the liability.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the liability there, what we're talking about is for securing it. And that security obligation is blind as to who ultimately obtained it, whether it's a member of the public or a member of the opposition or a
right.
member of the media.
It might come up against, potentially, theoretically, against whistleblower laws as well, such as the intricacies of this area. Just finally, John, the UK is facing some pretty big data privacy issues in the wake of Brexit, a potential reshaping of the UK General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR. Will you have a role in that, and how large could that be, potentially?
Yes, we will have a role. We've already made a comment on the public, the paper that, you know, the draft proposals that were published, and my office, my predecessor signed out a submission on that. So we've got an office position. I'll be reviewing that when I come in and speaking to the department that's sponsoring that legislation and speaking to the Secretary of State and the Minister about, you know, where we see the strengths and weaknesses and the opportunities and risks that those reforms represent. And then ultimately, of course, Parliament will make its decisions, and it'll be my job, I hope, to implement those.
Your most excoriating criticism was delivered via Twitter, and it was to the social media giants, to Facebook, and probably matched the mood of many people after the live streaming of that mosque atrocity. But beyond that one event, do you still retain a frustration at the way those social media giants function? And do you hold any hope for either their change of behaviour or a regulatory path that tempers it?
I do continue to be concerned and a little frustrated about some of the business practices that we see. These are business models based on exploiting personal information. So there's an inherent tension with privacy regulators. But there's a whole lot of issues that involve the kind of content that people are allowed to post, the sort of content that they are fed. Some of these are squarely data protection issues and some of them are not. There are issues about competition and consumer practices. So I think as a regulatory community, we do need to come together to face those. As to the second part of your question, is there further regulation on the horizon? There definitely is. The drums are beating. I think, we've seen in the UK, there is an online safety legislation. Those kinds of rules are being looked at in different places around the world. Where it really matters in the US, we are seeing also moving towards a federal privacy act, I hope, and also closer oversight of some of these organisations.
John, thank you. And go well. John Edwards.
Catherine, can I just say before I go, we've spoken many times over the years, and before I was commissioner, as a legal commentator on the show, and I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for the wonderful work that you do bringing the information from my office and from a wide range of interests and specialties to the people of New Zealand. You do a fantastic job, and have a wonderful Christmas.
Thank you. I truly appreciate that. Thanks very much. John Edwards.